You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
So today we have two panels. In the first panel, we are very happy to have with us Mr. Grant Harris, who's serving as a special assistant to the president and Senior Director for African Affairs on the National Security Staff of the White House. We have 30 minutes with Mr. Harris. Can I call you Grant?
Absolutely.
We have 30 minutes with Grant, and I will invite you to stay for the second part of the panel where we have three former U.S. ambassadors to Nigeria. So now the challenge here for me is to keep this within 30 minutes and open the floor for Q&As. So when I will open the floor for Q&A, I'm asking you to keep it very concise so that we can really have an efficient 30 minutes. So Nigeria, largest economy in Africa since the rebasing of its GDP, largest population in Africa. You cannot speak about Africa without talking about Nigeria. So, Grant, what I would like you to do for the first question is really from where you sit at the White House to give us a sense of how you see Nigeria and how you've been dealing in Nigeria all before the elections, all the way to the elections, and after the elections.
Sure.
So that's a little bit the theme, you know, before, during, and after. So the first question I have is that the U.S. pushed very hard to support peaceful and successful elections in Nigeria. We remember President Obama issuing a personal message to the Nigerian people. We have Secretary Kerry traveling to the country. So can you give us a little bit a sense of the process and the reasons why the U.S. worked so hard before the elections?
Sure, absolutely. And thank you for having me. Thank you to everyone for coming out for this conversation. The point that you started with, I think, is a really good point because it puts it into perspective. And that's what the United States did in the immediate lead-up to the election and drawing back from that why. Because in the immediate lead-up to the election, we did some things that aren't always the case. Normally, before a major election, it's very unusual for the Secretary of State to travel out so soon before voting because we're concerned that it might play to one side or the other or be spun by one side or the other. Yet in this case, we did. Normally, of course, it's not the norm for President Obama to issue a personal appeal to the citizens of a country right before an election and to call for calm and to call for orderly and peaceful voting. And in addition to that, we had Secretary Kerry post an op-ed in major newspapers with his UK counterpart. And we had a whole range of outreach to religious leaders, to civic leaders, northerners to southerners across the country. We had fanned out through our embassy and, of course, through everyone that we knew to try to advance this message, which was really a very simple message, and that was to have a peaceful poll and to ensure that any sort of disputes or any sort of tensions were resolved peacefully and through the courts and not in the streets. Because we had real nervousness, as I think many in the international community did, in the lead-up that there were a lot of elements pulling at the resilience of the country and that were creating what might be a tinderbox. You had a contentious election, which in and of itself is not a bad thing. It's a great thing to have a contentious election between competing political parties, setting forth competing visions. But there had been history in the past sometimes of the political tensions boiling over into violence. You had an economy that was sagging as well. And at that point, the stock market, I think, had been down some 27% at the point when we were really trying to assess how things were going. And you had, the conflict with Boko Haram, where the government had not been making progress and where there were real instances and real concerns about the type of violence that Boko Haram might sow on the polls and how that might have an effect. And so as we were looking at this, we simply decided that Nigeria is so important, that this election is so important, that we needed to leave no card unturned as to what the U.S. government could do to get out its message and to try to influence in whatever way we could a positive outcome. Now, realizing that what happened in Nigeria was because Nigerians acted as they did, but we in the international community wanted to make sure that we were sending all of the right messages, both positive messages, but also what were really unveiled threats that we would pursue visa bans and other measures against those who pursued violence. The reason that we did that, to which I alluded, is that, and as to which you alluded as well, Nigeria plays an incredibly important role in the region. And this election, I think, was important both for other countries looking at how to navigate contentious elections, but it was also important as an opportunity for Nigeria to really restore itself to a role that it had played in the past. And with democratic gains and with a peaceful election, we saw it being positioned and postured to really make gains, both internally against Boko Haram, to right the economy, and also to restore its place inside the broader region as an exporter of security, as a vital voice in ECOWAS, as an important peacekeeper around the continent. And so it seemed to be an incredibly important decision point in a country that is an indispensable partner for us.
Mm-hmm. Actually, that was my second question. Second question would have been, how really important is Nigeria? I mean, just as a country, but also as one of the dominant player in the region.
Right.
Yeah. And yeah. So I don't know if you want to follow up. It's just not just the security, but also the the economic side and so on.
Yeah. I think the answer is very important. But with Nigeria's challenges, you've seen it pull back in some of its peacekeeping commitments. Mm-hmm. The economy had not been leading the region the way it really should. Mm-hmm. And you've seen the stock market take a dip. And as we were speaking with U.S. investors, global investors, and others, there was real concern about the underlying strength of the economic direction and some of the policies in place. And you saw Nigeria looking abroad and looking potentially to international financial institutions and elsewhere in a way to provide support in a way that was less common in the past and which showed that there was a severe challenge. Mm-hmm. And when you saw as well that the advances that Boko Haram had been making, the Boko Haram challenge was really metastasizing, and it had spilled over the border and with attacks and drawing in Niger and Chad and Cameroon. And so it seemed to have reached a point where, whether it was a tipping point or not, it's really unclear in hindsight, but it was a point where the threat was very real. And it was a regional threat. It was a regional problem. Mm-hmm. And the devastation that this group was sowing, both in Nigeria and outside of Nigeria, showed that if left unchecked, it could really metastasize further.
Yeah, definitely. So now we're continuing our journey all the way now to the day of the elections on May 29th. And you were there. By the way, in true Nigerian fashions, the stock market rebounded, and they call this rebound the Buhari bounce. So now we are on May 29th.
Right.
Can you give us a sense of how you felt and how it was to be there? I mean, Laurent Fabius from Minister of Foreign Affairs for France was there. President Zuma was there and other dignitaries. And I think we all felt, I know personally how happy I was at that day, and we have this collective sigh of relief. But could you please give us a sense of how it was to be there
on
May 29th?
There was a lot of excitement in the country. And in speaking to many friends and colleagues who had recently traveled to Nigeria post-election but pre-inauguration, they were also talking about a buzz. And they were saying that it was some of their best visits in a long time because of the excitement and the optimism. Some were saying that it was a moderated optimism, and I think we'll have to see, because clearly there are high hopes for the new administration. And for our side, President Obama requested that Secretary Kerry lead a presidential delegation, which included a lot of senior officials. It included also Hakeem Olajuwon, a very prominent Nigerian-American who's beloved in the country and obviously an NBA great here at home. And so we were trying to highlight in that delegation both the strong government-to-government ties, but also those people-to-people ties that you had mentioned, which go back for decades and for generations. As we were watching the inauguration unfold, and especially as President Buhari and Ambassador Sanders and others who are in the stands, I'm sure will speak to this, especially as President Buhari was inspecting the military parade and inspecting the services and seeing them as he drove by and was waving to the crowd, and you heard the crowd really get excited. I think that was the pinnacle for me of the excitement and the hope. And we had a lot of trouble actually leaving the inauguration because there were so many youth in the street. Mm-hmm. And they were excited and just trying to be close to the event and be a part of it. And so I think the optimism is there. Getting back, though, to the government-to-government relationship and to some of the challenges, I think the key now, though, is that President Buhari appoints the right people for these senior positions, especially the economic portfolios, to have the technocratic skills and the ability really to undertake the right policy reforms. And then with respect to security leadership, mm-hmm. that he makes sure that he's got strong leaders that are making a push for transparency and are making a push really for a comprehensive approach to combat Boko Haram mm-hmm. that's leveraging security tools but also leveraging development gains and economic growth.
Yeah, this is a nice segue to the third part of this journey, now post-elections, and then we have all these electoral promises that are out there.
Right.
At AGI, we really love numbers, so we dig up some numbers from Credit Suisse, although we're not advocating you invest your money through Credit Suisse. But so they have this report about the likelihood of Buhari and the APC, his party, delivering on its campaign promises. Hmm. So they put the odds. So the odds are low for 6 of 10 major policy priorities: economic growth, job creation, socioeconomic development, public finances, food security, and economic infrastructure. On the other hand, the odds are high for 3 of 10 of the electoral promises: security, corruption, and governance. So it seems to, this is just one, of course, set of data, and I'm sure if we were to do a poll here, we would have different results. Mm-hmm. But at least we can all agree that there are two big issues here. One is the security, the corruption, the governance, where the new president is coming with a big capital, having in the past been in power and having shown a bit given some signals there to address these issues. But then we have the price of oil going down. We've seen fuel shortages. We've seen Q1 GDP going down. And we also see, you mentioned the youth, right? Mm-hmm. But we've seen the demographics, and we know that we have a large young population that need jobs.
Right.
So how do you see these two big challenges, right? And how the U.S., first of all, what the policies the new president should take, and how the U.S. can really assist him.
Sure. Yeah. I think I keep skipping ahead in your questions. So I'll refer a little bit back to how I laid it out, but try to add to it as well. You're right that Nigeria continues to face very real challenges. And though there is a lot of hope with the new administration, the new president, it's going to depend on who he picks for the right jobs. It's going to depend on the views that he solidifies and that he pursues in his agenda. But there's also a broader system at play. And I think Nigeria watchers have seen and have commented that over time there seems to have been more strain on that system, that corruption has deepened, that some of the underlying economic ability seemed to be not achieving its full potential, that the part of the security gains made by Boko Haram were because of some of the challenges in resourcing the Nigerian military. And so I think that he's got his work cut out for him to set the right course in combating those. And any instance like this, particularly one for such an important country, for such an important election that really exceeded expectations, those expectations will be exceedingly difficult to meet. Mm-hmm. And I say this as well, working for President Obama, who faced exceedingly high expectations when he took office, which didn't match the capability of any U.S. president in some venues to be able to achieve all hopes, given that you've got to be pushing an agenda, you've got to put the right people in place as much as we do. And so I think for President Buhari, it'll be key, as I mentioned, on the economic and security portfolios. Mm-hmm. It'll be key as well to be sending the right signals and to be taking incremental change as well in corruption and transparency, in governance, ensuring that there are a lot of things that the government can do, I think, to better institutionalize transparency as an objective. The bottom line is he's been saying the right things. He's been saying that he wants to pursue these security goals. He's been saying that he wants on the economic front to be doing more. And we as the U.S. government are more than keen to work with him and the new administration to do so. We had a partner in the last administration. We think also that President Buhari, with this agenda, may be able to uniquely make progress on some of these issues. And so we stand ready to deepen the security relationship. Mm-hmm. We stand ready to help in terms of any advice or support that we can provide on the economic agenda as well.
Okay. So now on the security, we've heard Secretary Kerry promising a renewal of U.S. commitment to military cooperation.
Right.
We know that there were some issues with the former administration in terms of military cooperation. But isn't it time also to think about, post-military campaign, if I may? So, for example, the former Deputy Assistant Secretary Tom Woods was mentioning the need to already think about DDRs and think about, stabilizing and reconstructing, let's say, for example, the Borno State and these areas. What are your views on that?
My views are absolutely. Mm-hmm. But I think some of that activity has been underway, but at a smaller scale than what we would need.
Mm-hmm.
And we should certainly plan for larger scale success and be ready for broader DDR and for broader stabilization activities. We've done some, speaking for the U.S. government, in trying to support these efforts, but you need to have the right holistic view of the challenge. And that's something I think that over preceding years, at different points, we felt that we needed a more comprehensive approach, and we've sought to support a more comprehensive approach, mm-hmm. because I think where the Nigerian security infrastructure has encountered setbacks and problems along the way has in part been due to being overly focused on the security tools mm-hmm. at their disposal.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to be thinking about it comprehensively, because when you look at the North, for instance, mm-hmm. and you look at the socioeconomic indicators and you look at the development, the lack of development gains, you see all too many people feeling disconnected from the capital, from the government, mm-hmm. from services that can be provided. And so what we've been urging and what we hope to work with the Nigerian government to do is to think, how do you bring in development tools? How do you bring in stabilization? How do you make gains so that you can counter violent extremism over the long term, even as you mm-hmm. use security tools to address the mm-hmm. immediate threat mm-hmm. from Boko Haram? And so some activities underway is the short answer, but I think we all need to be doing more and figuring out what is our plan to help.
Okay.
Seeing the kidnapping of many women and girls has mm-hmm. has brought into stark relief the need for reintegration and the mm-hmm. need for psychosocial services, the need for how to deal with the negative effects of this really callous violence that Boko Haram has perpetrated.
Mm-hmm.
And so that remains a challenge, but is simply an example of a way mm-hmm. that as you prosecute the war against Boko Haram, you've got to think about how you then support the communities, how you draw people away from Boko Haram as a group, and how you provide jobs and economic growth to make the situation all the more stable over the long term.
Yeah, I've got the signal that I have to open the floor and get some answers. I would have asked the last questions about the economic cooperation. We're a bit nervous about Exim Bank. Nigerian oil is no more being exported to the U.S. because of development here in fracking and technologies. So, but I'll keep that. Maybe somebody will help me out there and ask that question, but I have to open it to the floor. So please be concise so that we have about 10 minutes, and then I'll take a couple of questions. So I have one in the back there and one here in the front. I'll take this side too.
Dave Loudon, independent policy analyst. Can you speak at all, Mr. Harris, to efforts to reintegrate internally displaced people in Nigeria as a result of conflict with Boko Haram?
Sure, happy to.
Shall we just take
Absolutely.
A couple? Yeah, so I'll take one here. And I encourage people from the right side, which I'm not looking at, to ask questions to.
I know U.S. has stopped buying Nigeria oil since July 2014. Is there any prospect that America will start buying the oil now with the new administration?
So last question from this side. If not, I'm going to move back to this side. Okay. So there's one question.
I think there was a hint. One
oh,
hint
sorry.
Over.
Yes?
Yeah. I represent the African Queens Women Cultural Leadership Alliance. Even though I'm a gentleman, but have you tried to reach out to cultural leaders in Africa who are women, who are not encumbered with any political baggage, who can actually reach out maybe on the other side for dialogue.
Great. All right.
And would your administration support reaching out to such neutral parties, the cultural leaders?
Great.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Great questions. Let me try to take them in order. In terms of helping address the problem of internally displaced persons, which we've seen on a really alarming scale because of the violence, and also, of course, the flow of refugees to neighboring countries, we've tried to increase our humanitarian assistance, especially through the U.S. Agency for International Development. And we've also tried to encourage, though, coordination with other partners, because it's a bigger task than I think what we're able to bring to bear unilaterally. And also, the same would be true of the other major donors as well. And so what we've been doing in terms of coordinating with the government, and the ambassador, of course, of the government of Nigeria is here, and as part of an ongoing conversation, is how to provide these services, even despite the insecurity that has plagued many of the areas in which these internally displaced have been. And we saw it as, in addition to the humanitarian cost, there also was a political element in terms of the election and voting, which was something that was also of great concern. We were encouraging each political party and the major figures to come to agreement in how to ensure that these large groups were not disenfranchised through the polls, which could have, as well, opened up the election to claims of being insufficiently inclusive or to have been biased one way or the other. And I think much progress was made in that regard. There's still a lot more to do, though, particularly on the humanitarian side. In terms of oil, we don't have any policy in favor or against of buying oil from a country like Nigeria or elsewhere. It's really market factors that have driven the reduction of U.S. imports of Nigerian oil. But one thing, though, that I think was salient to me, having been in this position almost close to 4 years and having been speaking about Nigeria a lot, some of the comments at similar fora would be, what's driving your interest is the oil. And even as we've seen our imports dramatically decreased, our concern about the situation in Nigeria, our view that Nigeria should be a very important regional leader, and our view about the importance of the relationship is in no way diminished. It's only increased with the opportunities that we've seen. And then with respect to engaging women leaders and cultural leaders, that's absolutely something that we can be doing, we should be doing, we're trying to do, but I think there's more that we can be doing in that regard. I mentioned that in the run-up to the election, we tried to have a very broad outreach strategy. And one thing that I think is to our credit as a government, having looked at major elections and looked at major events, we've really tried very hard to diversify the stakeholders and the groups to whom we reach out with our messaging. We did this before the Kenyan election. We've done this at other critical elections, and we're doing this right now in trying to address the crisis in Burundi and elsewhere, where we look very deliberately at what sort of groups have influence, where our messaging can be felt, how we get out beyond the capital, how we get to groups in more rural areas, how we use religious communities and religious leaders to discuss with them and benefit from their ideas. Women and other leaders are a really important aspect of how we need to be thinking creatively about with whom we're engaging, whose ideas we benefit from, who also can be messaging similar things and who have the same interests as well in peace and stability in these situations.
Thank you very much. So we'll take another round of
sure.
Q&A just before the thing. So I'll start this time this way. I'll take one here, one there, and I'll take that gentleman there with the white thing, and then I'll take you. Please, if you could just be very concise, that we would appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Will Embry from DynCorp International. Given the Amnesty International report just came out on human rights abuses by the Army, what's the administration's position going to be on renewing military security assistance?
Yeah, that was you?
Sure.
Yeah, and with the white shirt.
Good afternoon. My name is Scott Morgan with Red Eagle Enterprises, and I was just wondering, can you give an update on what the administration has been doing to assist the Nigerian government in assisting to find the Chibok girls?
Okay, thank you. And I have two quick questions, the gentleman in the middle with the suit and the gentleman here. And then please stay after Grant finishes to answer his questions, because we have another round of very good comments on Nigeria.
Thank you very much. I must say that most of us Nigerians and others Africans in the diaspora are really excited with the change in Nigeria and are keen on contributing to maintaining the bright light that we see in Nigeria. And the diasporans are eager to be engaged with the U.S. and the U.S. agencies to enable them, mobilize themselves to make sure that they contribute to the continuation of the progress. Is there any way that your administration can encourage the Africans and Nigerians in particular in diaspora to engage and contribute, because a lot of Nigerians are now in the diaspora and we need to use our exposure and experience to do see that we maintain the future trend? Please, is there any way the government can help us? Thank you.
So last question here. Please be very concise.
Thank you. Toby Mbu from the Center for International Studies and Development. You talked about economy and Buhari appointing his cabinet ministers. Can you give some practical examples or things to do to diversify Nigeria's economy away from petroleum and oil?
Sure. Okay, great. Okay. Let me try to tackle with another great set of questions. First, in terms of the Amnesty International report and the recent reporting about human rights violations by Nigerian security services, these continue to be a real source of concern for us. We've continued our partnership with the Nigerian military, but we've continued as well to be fully consistent with our legal obligations in terms of Leahy vetting and ensuring that we're working with vetted troops and that our training is meant to support a culture of respect for human rights and of approaching these difficult challenges in the right way, in a way that really respects and lifts up the rights and dignity of the population. At different points, we've been more or less publicly vocal about some of our concerns, particularly at the height of the very concerning allegations about what was happening at Giwa Barracks and about the detention of those who were suspected of being part of Boko Haram. A lot of our security assistance goes to things that, whether it's judicial-related or infantry battalion training, which had been turned off temporarily by the government. We're hoping to restart that. A lot of this goes to trying to support a culture, as I mentioned, of being able to address Boko Haram and these security challenges in a way that's fully consistent with Nigeria's legal obligations. And there's really no other way to say it. There's certainly been challenges. We certainly have concerns about the treatment and respect for human rights in a way that we've been candid with the government and will continue to do so. And I think that confronting Boko Haram is going to take all of the tools, as I mentioned, at the government's disposal, but they've got to be levied in a way that show the utmost respect for its international legal obligations. And so with these and any other reports of concern, we go through them quite carefully, and we ensure that what we're doing as part of any security assistance that we provide is really meant to be part of the solution and really foster that type of culture and that type of approach. With respect to the Chibok girls and those who've been abducted, when that originally occurred, We immediately increased our assistance, particularly in intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, and other means to try to help the government locate where these missing girls were. And of course, though this particular instance got a lot of international attention, this practice, unfortunately, has been continuing for some time, and we've been trying to help all the girls, particularly those recently recovered, but women and girls who were recovered by the Nigerian army in terms of psychosocial support, in terms of counseling. We plussed up our embassy team at one point by about 30 people or so when these girls were originally abducted, and we had people from across our departments and agencies with their specific skill sets trying to help locate, trying to help provide counseling and services to those who were located, and trying to do what we could with the Nigerian government to make their response as effective as possible. And that, of course, is a search that is ongoing, though they have had success in locating and freeing some women and girls. And we're also quite concerned about the fate of many young boys and men as well in towns and villages that were attacked by the Nigerian army, and there are far too many disappearances. There are far too many young boys and men who are unaccounted for. And we see that, I think, a level of despicable violence perpetrated by Boko Haram that speaks to that speaks to what it stands for as a group, and that we need to continue to do everything that we can to counter. In terms of working with the diaspora, it's a great idea, and it's something that I think we need to be doing more of. It's a theme that comes up time and again, and we've tried to implement this idea in a few different ways, some more specific to Nigeria, others more broadly to sub-Saharan Africa across the board, including in ways in highlighting the economic opportunities and the trade and investment agenda that we've been working on. For instance, under the Doing Business in Africa campaign, we have an element in which our Department of Commerce is working with diaspora groups to try to really use their interest and expertise and their ties to these different countries to highlight both the investment opportunities but also to encourage the type of U.S. tools that we can bring to bear to support, which is the most artful way I can come up with as well to say that EXIM is a really important tool of the U.S. government. And to getting to your previous comment, it's something that we're quite concerned about. It's very important that EXIM be reauthorized so that we can continue to use these tools to support investment and trade. But the short answer is there's more that we can do on with the diaspora in particular. We really welcome those ideas of how to do it. And we have many programs, but I think that it's most helpful to hear from members of the diaspora about where we're getting it right and where there are opportunities to be doing more. And then finally, in terms of diversifying the Nigerian economy, I think, to start with, though you're speaking, of course, to diversifying beyond petroleum, to start with, it's critical that there be more transparency in the petroleum sector. And it's critical that the government take actions to try to increase that transparency across the board so that the receipts are known, so that the government is confronting some really tough issues in ensuring that the people of Nigeria see the benefit of the natural resources of Nigeria. And I think that there's more that can be done in that regard. Now, beyond diversifying beyond that, Nigeria's got a lot of resources, as you know, and I think there needs to be a broader economic plan in how to do so. It's going to go back to the leadership, as I mentioned, and it's going to go back to having the right ministers with the right vision of how to get there and how to do it. And I think these are many different questions. It's hard to pull them all together. What it gets at fundamentally is where you started. And that's in terms of the importance of Nigeria and also the importance of our relationship with Nigeria. So we're going to continue to work with the government of Nigeria as partners. We know that partners don't always see eye to eye. We know that there are challenges as well. But Nigeria is an incredibly important partner for the United States, both the security challenges, the economic potential, for all the reasons that we've touched on here. And so you'll continue to see more from this administration in trying to deepen those ties and support this new administration in Nigeria in making these tough decisions and in putting in place the right team.
Yeah. So the journey continues. Please join me in thanking Mr. Harris with a round of applause, and we hope to see you again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Please stay on your seat because we're not done and you can ask another question.
Great.
Good afternoon. My name is Whitney Schneidman, and I'm a non-resident fellow here at the Africa Growth Initiative at Brookings. Before I introduce the panel, let me just introduce Ambassador Adefuye, Nigeria's ambassador to the United States. Good to see you, sir. Welcome. So we have an extremely distinguished panel, and we're just thrilled to be having this conversation about Nigeria. Just brief introduction. To my left is Professor Rotimi Seburu, who is a professor at Bennington College and author of Federalism and Ethnic Conflict in Nigeria. To his left is Ambassador Thomas Pickering, who was U.S. Ambassador to Nigeria 1981 through 1983. To his left is Ambassador Robin Sanders, who is the CEO of FEEDS and former ambassador to Nigeria 2007 to 2010, and Ambassador Princeton Lyman, who's senior advisor to the president of the United States Institute of Peace and was ambassador to Nigeria from 1986 to 1989. We've got a lot of ambassadors here, former ambassadors, and we're just thrilled to get into this. Ambassador Lyman, let me start with you, because several years ago you criticized Nigeria very publicly for failing to play a leadership role in Africa. And in February, you called for the elections to be postponed. And indeed they were. And I think this establishes you as the bona fide clairvoyant on this panel. So given the recent elections and their outcome, what does the Buhari government need to do as a first priority to seize the incredible momentum and excitement that was generated by this historic transition?
Well, I was happy that it came out as well as it did, and it came out marvelously. Look, he has several priorities, but I disagree with the Credit Suisse assessment, quite frankly. I think the most difficult areas he's going to have are security and corruption. Security, because the reform of a security service while you're in the middle of a conflict is always very difficult. And second, there's a real generation gap between General Buhari, President Buhari, and the leadership of the military today. And changing that and getting in and building a new cadre of military support is not going to be easy. And on corruption, a lot of it is institutionalized. It's built deeply into the system. He's going to have people not only who understand the system, but are as committed as he is to weeding out the corruption. I think those are two major challenges he's going to have to get at right away. Whereas on the economic front, I think there are a lot of people, business and others, ready to jump in and now help on the economic side. I think that's where he's going to start to see some success.
But actions, what kind of actions are you looking for that's going to make you say, this is for real here?
Well, I think he has to shake up the military leadership. I think the amnesty report is damning. And yet he has to do it in a way that it doesn't collapse. Mm. And that means new appointments right away. He also has to make a commitment to the people of the Northeast and the North that it's not going to be just a military campaign. There's going to be a real investment in the North and jobs and other things to take away the appeal that Boko Haram has. And second, who he appoints. Who he appoints on the economic side in the petroleum industry and gives them the authority and power to move quickly on at least getting the most serious corruption under control.
Professor Seburu, corruption has been an issue that's marred Nigerian governance for some time, and it's been talked about a lot. Certainly President Buhari and his campaign made it one of the top priorities. What can we realistically expect from him? How does he begin to tackle this issue such that it makes a difference in the lives of the everyday Nigerian?
Yeah, thank you. I think it is realistic to expect that there will be a major fight against corruption under Buhari for several reasons. I think his reputation and integrity, you know, as a former Minister of Petroleum, as a former head of state, he is one of the Nigerian leaders who has been, you know, relatively incorruptible. In fact, in the North, he's called Megaskia, which means the honest one, you know, reflecting, you know, that experience. The second reason why I think it is realistic to expect that, you know, there will be a major fight against corruption under Buhari is because it's such a centerpiece of his campaign. And then a third reason why I think we can be optimistic is that in the past, under President Obasanjo, for example, when the political leadership has been committed to fighting corruption, we've seen some results, you know, like the EFCC under Ribadu. At the same time, there are several reasons, you know, to be pessimistic. One is that, you know, this is Buhari's fourth attempt at the presidency. His previous three attempts failed. And in being successful during this fourth time, he has had to build a coalition, which includes, unfortunately, a lot of politicians that are known to be very corrupt. The institutions for fighting corruption in Nigeria are also very weak. The EFCC and the ICPC have been used as instruments of political victimization and intimidation by the politicians. And, of course, you know, the oil costs, you know, the rentier state that Nigeria is, you know, with the government deriving an overwhelming proportion of revenues from, you know, oil rather than from taxation. So those are factors that will tend to suggest some pessimism. But overall, I think we can be cautiously optimistic that Buhari will fight corruption, especially if he goes beyond a personal example to, you know, implementing some institutional reforms and building the institutions for fighting corruption.
Should we expect him to prosecute people of the past administration for actions related to corruption?
I think his policy has been that he's not going to spend a lot of time, you know, going out, you know, that he'll be more focused on, you know, providing, you know, ensuring that his own government includes people that are not corrupt. But in very blatant cases of corruption, you know, like the famous missing $20 billion,
right.
I think it would be absolutely necessary to, you know, to investigate those.
Right. Ambassador Pickering, you knew President Buhari in 1983 when you were ambassador to Nigeria. And at that time, he came into government through military force and had a reputation as an authoritarian leader. And now he's been reborn as a Democrat. You've been ambassador in five countries and the United Nations. Have you seen this kind of conversion before? And from what you knew of him then, what do you expect now?
No, Nigeria is a country of ultimate tests in many ways, and quite unique. And so in the search for any parallel, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find it. I think on the one hand, it's quite damaging that a paper as respected as the New York Times found it necessary to lead every headline with military dictator. When, in fact, what President Buhari did after the coup was to, with a very heavy hand, weed out corruption. If a heavy hand was needed then, I cannot tell you what is needed now is something close to miraculous. And I agree with what I've heard from both Princeton and Professor Sibero. To some extent, people tell me that Buhari's never been briefed by anybody from the former government, that he has no idea of where the money has gone and where the money now isn't, if I could put it that way. He has an economic crisis, and I think the economic crisis, which is in large measure driven by corruption but also driven by other factors, is a principal requirement for him to undertake to prove to the people who, as ebullient as they are now, are going to have to see serious changes down the road. And I think that dealing with the energy problem as well as corruption are all very, very serious demands on what is now a single one-man administration. I have a sense that he might go back to being petroleum minister as well, recognizing that the heart of much of the corruption lies on the bad handling of income, and the petroleum ministry, unfortunately, has perhaps a role as the centerpiece of that. Not that there is any easy silver bullet. I also think that he is in some way, because of his statements, deterred from the notion that he can be blatantly ruthless about corruption and still avoid the headlines of the New York Times, if I could put it that way. And I don't blame the New York Times individually, but I think it is too bad that the one memory of Buhari is something he's being castigated for because he was perhaps excessive in his zeal in trying to end a long time, terribly difficult, serious problem in Nigeria of corruption. And I think that that's a hard road for him to hoe. I agree also with Princeton, just to add one other thing. The chiefs of the military have not performed with brilliance, and he will have to deal with that. And it is an awfully hard job to what we could call reprofessionalize the military leadership, if I could call it that. And that is a connotation of politicization of the military leadership under the former administration, as you know well. To reprofessionalize the military leadership in a situation where he has an impossibly difficult conflict to flight. And at the same time, I think, as Princeton said, Northeast has been devastated, and much of the infrastructure has been hurt, and people's individual property holdings and things of that sort have been destroyed. And so he will have to reach out in that area, not only to bring back jobs and business, which are very important, but to help people with housing and with all of the structural things that have disappeared now in the middle of what is a terribly difficult conflict. So I have no sense other than to say, if one were to try to find the worst of all possible circumstances into which to transition,
this
in all honesty, I think one would be hard, either in fact or in fiction, to find one worse than what President Buhari has to face. He's buttressed by the fact that, in a way that I find marvelous, Nigerians have risen to the call of the country again.
Yeah, very
and
much.
All over Nigeria. This is just not a northern phenomenon, I think.
And just let me follow up quickly. Do you expect excessive zeal to continue to characterize his governance style?
No, he said, I may have been guilty of excessive zeal, I've learned. And I think he needs, obviously, the running room to do it. I think, finally, all who consider and value Nigeria as an important country and a friend, and that's this country, need now to find a way to reach out, to try to help someone who has emerged in a set of circumstances almost in a messianic way, to try to deal with a huge range of very, very difficult problems, particularly maybe helping deal with the military, helping with reconstruction, helping with some of the management issues, if that's what he wants, are very important. And I think he does. And I think, finally, people tell me, I wasn't there, and Robin and Grant and others would know, but apparently there is a strong sense of appreciation of the view that the U.S. has taken in the period of the elections and what Grant termed as perhaps I would call a balanced interest in success in the elections in Nigeria has redounded in an enormously positive way for the United States. So the United States faces a test in Nigeria at this time. Is it prepared to come through with what was the promise of its actions? And in many ways, that will be important because I think it can help bolster things. But I think the rest of Europe and other places that have a long-term interest in Nigeria is, after all, a world country. I won't say a world power, but a world country. It has influence that's greater than its reach, its size, its economy, and other things, put it in a position of being able to play. Buhari was invited to the G7, went to the G7.
Right.
That's an important, significant recognition. And somehow that has to happen, too.
Right.
So one could be up here for an hour and a half and talk about all these problems.
That would be all our time.
Yeah.
But thank you. Ambassador Sanders, let me come to you and ask, just drill down a little bit on the question of oil. And you... You clearly dealt with it when you were ambassador. You were there at the inauguration. There is discussion that President Buhari may indeed take up the position as oil minister. Is that a good idea? Is that the best way to get this behemoth under control and really bring in sort of new thinking? Or is it really to appoint the really good people that are out there and let them do their job?
Well, I think it's both. I need to step back just a little bit. I was not only out there for the inauguration, but I was an election observer as well. And I was in the north central region of the country. And it was evident, certainly early on, that, you know, the pendulum was definitely swinging to a different political dynamic. But I also want to add sort of the positive part. I know we've all highlighted a little bit of the negative part, but there are a couple of unwritten things that I saw, particularly being out there during the inauguration. Even though, you know, the PDP was in shock, what I did see and what I do want to note was that a lot of them dusted themselves off and participated quite statesmanlikely in the inaugurational activities. And I think that's kind of a second social bounce. You had the market bounce, but I think there was a little bit of that social bounce that took part. And I think that the outgoing president kind of set the stage for that. In direct answer to your question, we've talked a lot about the oil sector, and I think that when we look for actionable items to do early on, one that I would put on the table is really redo the audit. Redo the oil audit, particularly given the fact that there was a lot of comments about the oil audit in terms of its veracity and its usefulness, quite frankly. And I think that, you know, we also have to recognize that this is a smart man. And, you know, we're sort of saying what he should do and what we want him to do. He has a plan. He has a vision. I actually listened to his speech in detail, and I actually walked away and recently did an article in the Huffington Post, which I called the Buhari Doctrine. He was very, very clear on where he wanted to go and what he wanted to do. Furthermore, he has some great technical people around him. Yes, he's got a whole cadre of politicians that he has to deal with, but he has some extremely close advisors that are really smart technical people across the board in all sectors. So I think we need to, you know, take that into account. His vice president, I recently was on a board with him the last year or so. I don't know him extremely well, but I know him from that board position. He was a former attorney general as well in the state of Lagos. And so he has some really good people that can help him on corruption, that can do some of the leadership things that we talk about. The key is he knows who he's probably going to pick for his ministers. We may not. I understand that he's keeping that very, very close to his chest. Even his closest advisors don't know that yet. I think he's done a couple of really good things right out of the box. In addition, his very first visit was to Niamey, not to the G7. And the fact that he recognized his neighbors in his speech in terms of their role in security, going to Niamey first, really reaching out at the social level of the country. And I think, you know, if anything, I think that this there's this artificial 100-day ticker that's always out there when the new administration comes in. And given the expectations that are there for him, I think he needs to move that artificial ticker further out for himself, to give himself enough time so he's not measured in 100 days, but really measured in concrete terms. We talked a little bit about other sectors. I would add two that have been, one hasn't been mentioned, but one has briefly been mentioned, the agricultural sector. You've got to address the agricultural sector. You have about 80% of the population in the agricultural sector making a dollar, put it this way, not making, but in search of $1.25 a day. That's not a confirmation that they will actually achieve $1.25 a day. So, yes, the private sector is important, but I really think that it's more than what the private sector can do unless they're looking at doing vocational training, entrepreneurial training, and that's not what they're looking to do. So he's going to have to come up with some kind of jobs program at the grassroots level in order to really turn this around. So the oil sector, I think right off the bat, if he asks for the audit to be redone, that really sends a signal, a very easy one, in a lot of ways, to really underscore. And if he ends up being a petroleum minister like he was before, then I think that that, you know, he can have good oversight over that. I had an opportunity twice to go to his house when I was there. I sat on two panels or three panels with him about democracy when I was there as ambassador. And so you could see this growth. You could see this shift that was happening. So we have to give him a chance, and certainly the U.S. has to figure out how it's going to better help him.
Let me ask you, there are two memorable lines from his inaugural address.
Right.
One is, you know, I belong to everybody and I belong to no one. That's clear.
Right.
But when he says the past is prologue, What's he really talking to there?
Yeah, I cited both of those because they were so profound that you could almost hear a pin drop when he first said, you know, I belong to everybody, I belong to nobody. And it was almost like this huge exhale came out of the crowd when he said that. The other phrase that was very poignant to me was the past is prologue. And my analysis on both of those, certainly the first one is evident as corruption, but the second one was, okay, you know, let's just put all the political infighting behind and put the benefit and the well-being of the nation first. And I think that some of the previous members of the ruling party took that on board as a welcome to participate. And I think that we need to also take that on board as a welcome to participate as the international community and as friends of the nation. And so I think that he also had one other point that didn't get as much play but I thought was equally important. He was asking the labor unions to give him time. He said, you know, I want the Federation of Workers, of the labor unions, to also give me time, which means he notes that that expectations are high, but he also knows that he's going to need lots and lots of time to get it together. So I think we need to recognize that he probably knows where he wants to go. He's very clear on his Bihari doctrine. What we need to do as friends and of the nation is really support him in his efforts to get there.
Great. Professor Sabo, let me come to you, because on the previous panel and on our discussion here, the North has been mentioned several times, but in his inaugural address, President Buhari pretty much said that he's going to end the amnesty program in the South. And he said that the government will invest heavily in projects and programs still in place. Is this the right approach? Is this a signal of a northern president sort of saying, you're on your own to the Delta region? And if he's going to invest in these programs, where's he going to get the money to do that?
Thank you. I mean, to reinforce the point you've made, I think, you know, the Niger Delta, as we know, has developmental and environmental challenges. And, you know, their sense of grievance and alienation has been deepened, you know, quite clearly by the defeat of Jonathan, who is the first indigene of Niger Delta to be the president of Nigeria and has only served one term. But having said that, the decision to end the amnesty was actually a decision that was made by the previous administration. You know, they started the amnesty in 2009, and they decided that at the end of this year, the amnesty would terminate. Partly because, you know, there has been a lot of fraud in the program. Partly because, you know, it's not been effective in stopping bunkering, although it has at least helped to stop violence in the Niger Delta. But I think there are other strategies, you know. There are other processes in place that can be, you know, if properly democratized and if properly utilized, can actually serve to alleviate the problems of the Niger Delta. One is the, you know, the Niger Delta Development Commission. You know, which receives, you know, monies from the federal government, from the state governments, and from the oil companies. Mm-hmm. You know, this, you know, a multi-million dollar, you know, a project. And for now, the NDDC has been, you know, ravaged by corruption. I think, you know, promoting greater transparency within the NDDC would be extremely helpful. There's the 13% derivation money that goes to the oil-producing state. That's a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that Buhari said in his speech is that under his watch, he would not allow corruption to continue to go on at the subnational level. And corruption at the subnational level is extremely severe. So if some mechanisms can be put in place to ensure that that 13% allocation is actually used by the oil-producing states, you know, that would be helpful. A final point is, under Obasanjo, a decision was made to apply the 13% derivation principle, not just to onshore revenues, but also to offshore. Initially, there seemed to be a political support consensus behind this, but since then, there has been a backlash, especially in the North, against the inclusion of offshore revenues. I think it will be very essential for Buhari to continue that consensus of including offshore oil revenues in the 13% derivation.
So you see this more as a transition, sort of a graduation of an approach to dealing with the
precisely. I think those other institutions, the NDDC, the 13% derivation formula, and including offshore oil revenues, if properly managed, you know, will go a considerable extent to alleviating the grievances of the Niger Delta. Mm.
Great. Thank you. Ambassador Lyman, I want to pick up a theme from the previous panel, and that was sort of in December, I think it's fair to say that U.S.-Nigerian relations reached a real low point when the Nigerian government said to the American military assistants, we don't want you. What we want are what you won't give us, Cobra helicopters. And we said, we have huge problems with your human rights
activities in your military, and reference was made to the Amnesty report that was just published last week. How do we bridge this gap? How do we build trust in this relationship so that the U.S. can be the partner on security that it would like to be, but still conform with our expectations of what a partnership's all about?
Well, I think the opportunity is there, as people have said, and President Buhari has said he wants to deepen this relationship, and I think it's a great opportunity. Look, on the security front, it's going to be very difficult. There's going to be resistance inside the security establishments to some of the reforms that we and he would like to see. I think the way to do this is stick as closely as possible to him and his Minister of Defense as to how they want to do this, the way they can do it, the way they're going to move, clean it up, and we get behind that, go to the officers they pick that they single out, we put them through Leahy check, and follow his lead on how to reform this military and make them effective. I don't think we can do it without that. I agree with the professor that he's serious about this. It's going to be hard, but if we follow him on this, I think we'll find ways to help on the security side in the areas that will get good officers doing the right thing.
I think that Princeton put his finger in it. I think he's very conscious of the Leahy process. I first dealt with it years ago at Columbia when we had a similar problem of what were basically rampant abuses by an existing police and military force. And we started out helping one and then a second battalion, and they were carefully vetted. Now, I don't know our capacity to vet in Nigeria. It's much more limited than it was in Colombia. But it's a way to begin, and obviously one has to begin with the officers, but the Leahy vetting requirements require you look down through the whole unit. Mm. But if you can begin that way, hard as it is, I think one really quite capable military unit is better than 30 bad ones that are, in fact, recruiting tools for Boko Haram. And in that sense, it's a serious problem. Maybe others can help as well. I think President Buhari has this enormous capacity to change the paradigm. The previous paradigm was it's bad and it's not getting better. And the new paradigm, it's Buhari, and it can get better. Mm. And we have to work to try to help him do that. There's a certain amount of trust and faith that he brings to the table, if I could put it that way, that is enormously important. But I think the really difficult problem, and Robin touched on it too very well, he can't do everything. And he knows he's going to have to bring in the government. And he has, I think, as Professor Subiru said, obligations to a party, which is unusual. But even military guys get caught up in party politics. He has obligations to a party which is not necessarily a total exemplar of everything that wasn't in place politically. And he's going to have to work with that and choose very carefully. The good news, he has some good people. A lot of them are technocrats who bring to the table the knowledge of how to govern well and the knowledge of the subject matter. So starting out with that base, it'll be absolutely fascinating to see in the next 3 weeks who forms the cabinet.
Right.
It'll be absolutely fascinating to see what their record is.
Let me just get Ambassador Sanders' take, given that you were there most recently
issues. Yeah, I just got back on Friday, actually.
Your ambassadorship.
And one of the things I wanted to say on security sector reform, because I know we've talked a lot about the military, but I would argue that you would have to look at security sector reform across the board. And, you know, everything shouldn't go out, you know, the baby with the bathwater. There are a couple of good programs from the previous administration that I really think, if possible, should stay on. And one is the PINE initiative, which pulls in all stakeholders. PINE means Presidential Initiative for the Northeast. And it is a very comprehensive group that includes donors, stakeholders, military, the National Security Advisor's Office, And under that, they're doing a lot of things looking at not only humanitarian, but also human rights issues as well. And what I understand they're thinking about, and as I said, this is an understanding, is that they're also looking at sort of, you know, pulling out the accusations on human rights violations and setting up a separate process in order to vet those and to be able to adjudicate those as well, so that you, if you, we have Leahy on one side and you have that other process for, by the government on the other side, then it's quite possible that we'll be able to really try to move forward in this regard. And I think the biggest thing to add to that, in addition to sort of the, this very comprehensive PINE program that does rehabilitation for IDPs, it's receiving some of the women that were recently refound and going through psychological. I mean, it's a very, very good program, and if they want to rename it, rename it. But I think that the fact that it's a very big stakeholder program, hopefully that will stay in place. The other two things that Buhari has done recently, President Buhari has done recently, which may or may not have gotten everyone's attention, is the first meeting he had was with the service chiefs. And so clearly he's already started that dialogue with the service chiefs. I think it's probably for him to get a sense of where things are, where things need to be. And then he has held over the National Security Advisor for 3 months, the current National Security Advisor. And I think that the strategic thinking on that, I would assume, is that, you know, if you're in the middle of a conflict, you can't just move everybody at once and you can't change everybody at once. And so I think that, you know, as we look at where we can step in as the U.S., I think these are vehicles where we can step in. You know, how do we make or how can we support the PINE process, or if they want to call it something else or add more to it, because it, they do actually have facilities around the Northeast where they're helping IDPs and some of the young women that have been abused by Boko Haram. You know, whether or not he removes all the service chiefs or none of the service chiefs or whatever, or some of them, or stagger the move, you know, whatever he decides to do, we have to be there to support them, not necessarily only with words, but we have to really be there with actions. We got to bounce as the U.S. out of this election and the inauguration. I think that whatever strains we had in our relationship in December, we got a bounce because of all the things we did leading up to the inauguration and the, also the election. So we need to also build upon that. But there's an expectation that it's going to be more than just press statements and things sure. like that. They're going to want to see actual resources come to bear. And so we're going to have to figure that out within the U.S. government, what that means and how much we can add to what we're doing.
Great. Thank you. Let me now turn to the audience and see if there are any questions here for a very distinguished panel. I'll take three at a time. Why don't I start over here with Ambassador Cohen.
Good afternoon. I gather that 80% of government revenue comes...
Can you introduce yourself?
I'm Hank Cohen, a syndicated columnist.
Otherwise known as all these former gentlemen's former boss.
I gather that 80% of government revenue comes from oil, and this the revenue from oil comes through the NNPC. What's wrong with abolishing the NNPC? Have Deloitte and Touche take care of the oil revenue and put it right into the budget.
Okay, thank you. Let me take another one, sir, right there.
My name is Okun Odo. I'm a private person. Every discussion on Nigeria is dominated by corruption. And Buhari has said many things since he was elected. I hope he will not be persuaded to pursue corruption as the first agenda, because that would be a recipe for failure. Among his supporters are many corrupt people. He needs them to succeed. So he should not start by going after them.
Can I just ask you to ask a question, please? If there's no question, we appreciate the statement.
My question is, we've heard how the U.S. went out of its way to do things they don't normally do before elections. A statement sent Secretary of State to Nigeria. Now they have a stake in this government. Since Buhari has been elected, what has U.S. decided to do? apart from the usual rhetorics, support, as Mr. Sanders has said, if the U.S. willing to do something more than the support, let us know.
Okay, thank you. Connie Freeman back there. Just please keep it brief so more people can get questions in. Thank you.
Connie Freeman, Syracuse University. We're all very excited about the outcome of the elections, and the discussion has been very positive, almost at a level of pink cloud. My question is, where is the chief opposition? Domestically, regionally, and even within the U.S. to supporting and helping Buhari to accomplish his goals?
Great, thank you. And Vivian, let me get you right.
Vivian Lowry Derrick, the Bridges Institute, and thank you for the tempered optimism that you all have reported. My question is about any remaining religious challenge to Buhari. Will effectively dealing with Boko Haram eliminate these tensions, or will the Christian-Muslim tensions still remain a big obstacle for him? Thank you.
Great, thank you. Princeton, do you want to
Let me comment on some of these things, because the question of where the opposition might come from, and it touches a little also on the corruption question. We haven't talked much about the governors. The governors are going to be critical. They get half the revenue. Ambassador Cohn mentioned where the revenue comes in. And they are responsible for carrying out a lot of the programs. He has got to inspire and get the governors on board with the same things he is driving at. Some of the corruption is in there, and I disagree about the corruption question. Billions have been poured into the Delta without success because of the corruption. So he's got to get at that kind of thing. But the governors, some of them are in his party, but in the Delta, they're not. And that's going to make the Delta even more difficult for him every step of the way. So part of the opposition, or at least the obstacles, are going to come with whether the governors are on board. And if he can get them to use their resources, which are going to be reduced, to get at some of these social and economic issues, it's going to make a big difference. On the religious question, you know, Boko Haram is attacking all the institutions of Nigeria. They're going after the Islamic institutions. They're going after the government institutions. They're going after the education institutions. I think one of the things that this election has done is take Boko Haram out of being a partisan issue and now a national issue. Mm-hmm. And I think attacking Boko Haram will not exacerbate the religious problems. Those are issues that have to be dealt with, but I don't think the attack on Boko Haram will make it any worse.
Robin, last week, William Wallace had a piece in the Financial Times advocating that Buhari privatize the NNPC. Mm-hmm. Is that one way to deal with the problem?
Well, I think that we have to really give him a chance to determine what he wants to do with NNPC. I think we can advise and we can suggest, but I think NNPC is such a behemoth and is so inculcated all the way down. I think that just wiping it out completely as a first step is probably not the way to go. I still go back to what I said before. Let's do the audit, try to figure out where the leakages are, and then do reform based on that, which may lead to abolishing NNPC down the line, but not as a first order. I just don't think that, that kind of shakeup is going to be sustainable. And I go to your point that the other point on corruption. Corruption is at the center, so you have to deal with it first. But the president was very clear on the other things that he thinks are important. If you go back and look at his speech, he talks about the key sectors that he wants to pay attention to that he believes are going to be critical for economic growth. We've talked about them a little bit here. You know, agriculture, it's rural electrification, it's, you know, job creation, entrepreneurial, vocational, all of those kinds of things. So, you know, I think we tend to zero in on corruption because we think it is. I mean, it permeates everything, but he also recognizes that these other things have to be done. On the Muslim-Christian issue, I think that Princeton is absolutely right. With the election of Buhari, it has taken the partisan angle out of out of the dynamic, and I think that that's an advantage for Buhari. I think we also have to recognize that his vice president is from the Southwest.
Yeah.
And he carries a fair amount of clout in the Southwest. And I think we also have to keep in mind that Buhari belongs to a party now. It's the APC. And the APC, I think we all need to be paying attention to the dynamics within the APC. Because one thing that they can do, which I'm not sure everybody knows, is they have veto power on the nominations. And so whoever he nominates, the party has to approve. And so we need to make sure the democratization process is also going on within the APC, because that could actually become a quagmire if we're not careful. So I just wanted to put that on the table.
That's great. That's great. Let me take some more questions, and then I'll come back over here. Ma'am.
Could I just make a point on Hank's question? Hank's question was half an NPC as an institutional structure, but I think it was two-thirds, if I could put it this way, how the money flows.
Mm.
And there may well be a possibility of separating a lot of the money, if I could put it this way, from NNPC. And that might not be a bad idea. I think Hank's view in that direction is one that I would share, that there may and ought to be a new, perhaps more accountable and responsible way. And it fits with Robin's view that the audit is a critical determinant of how and in what way that
what
might come. So I would think
have.
The other point I would make is that Boko Haram has never been an exclusively religiously fundamental organization. The bulk of its victims have been Muslims.
Right.
That it has combined itself with people whose interests were more in rural banditry, and in some cases political activists in support of various governors at various times. And so it has a kind of universalist malign franchise, which helped, I think, perhaps convince people that it wasn't the wave of the future for anybody Muslim in Nigeria. Hopefully that's true. And I think that part is very important. I also think the way the election went, Buhari did not do terribly in the country as a whole. And that's helped, I think. And that's helped to create potentially a sense of unity, which we will have to develop.
Right. It's a sizable win.
Mm-hmm.
And
thank you. Samantha Witzer, a consultant at the World Bank's Energy and Extractives Global Practice. I hope that all of the distinguished panelists agree that it takes at least two to tangle when it comes to corruption. And today, so far, we've spoken a lot about what the Nigerian government can do to alleviate the problem. What about the other international players? What about multinational oil companies and the EITI? How do you see the importance of having a multi-angle approach to corruption in Nigeria moving forward? Thank you.
Great. Thank you. In the back.
Hi, Channing May, Global Financial Integrity. With over 230,000 barrels of oil stolen every day, what steps can the Nigerian government take, changes made, programs instituted, to significantly reduce the amount of bunkering in the Niger Delta? Thank you.
Question here.
Thank you very much. Aloysius Odu, Partnership for Transparency Fund. Oil, of course, dominates the Nigerian economy. I was just wondering what the panel thinks about the huge untapped domestic resource mobilization outside of oil. Because there are questions about how do we finance these ambitious programs that are going to be unleashed in the next couple of years. But domestic resource mobilization remains a vital part of the agenda. And what do you think about that?
Take one more. Ma'am.
Hi. My name is Ladi, Premium Times Nigeria. My question is actually more about Ambassador Robbins. You said something about the APC, and one of the gaps we know we have in the democratic structure in Nigeria is a very, very weak and confused party base. I think the present crop of politicians, they are quite happy with all the support the U.S. gave before and after the election. But in the future, what are you doing to, I'm sorry, perhaps you are not the right people to address this to, but maybe the last guy who spoke, but you are the ones who are here now, so you have to answer this. What are you going to do, you know, to ensure that the parties, you know, develop their capacity to be a real democratic institution? Thank you.
Great, thank you. Professor Sabre, do you want to start with one of those questions about how to develop the party structure?
Yes, and, you know, in terms of opposition, I think the trends suggest that the APC itself is, you know, prone to fragmentation. You know, there have been the PDP has basically imploded, you know, but there are elements within the party trying to, you know, revitalize it and you know, make it a, you know, a sturdy opposition to the, you know, to the incumbent regime. I think in terms of what can be done to develop the party process, I think the most important factor will be the quality of the electoral process. You know, we've seen progress in terms of electoral reforms, you know, and I think if the, you know, electoral process is, you know, made more transparent, if INEC is made more independent of the executive, if some of the reforms that have been introduced by Professor Atariru Jega are deepened, we'll begin to see an electoral system that acts as an incentive for the parties to be internally democratic. I think one of the, for me, one of the big lessons of this experience is how the PDP, which felt it could remain in power for 60 years or indefinitely, has been, you know, in a way, shocked by, you know, the mobilization of the opposition and by the reforms in the electoral process. So I think electoral reform, you know, free, fair, honest elections will be a very strong incentive for, you know, political party development in Nigeria.
Ambassador Sanders, a question about Nigeria's untapped domestic capability and resources. I mean, at the end of the day, isn't that why we're all here, to see this country really move forward, driven by Nigerians for Nigerians?
Yeah, I think that the elections are and the inauguration are really a good start. And I think you're absolutely right. What are the untapped resources? Well, primarily it's the Nigerian people. It is by far, in my view, one of the most dynamic and creative countries that I've ever had a chance to serve in. And I think you have areas like agriculture. One that gets left out a lot, which I think is really critical, is housing. You have a 17-plus million housing deficit in Nigeria, which means that if you have people that are living at the $1.25 a day, they probably either do not have shelter or have very poor shelter. So agriculture, mobilization in terms of how you work with cooperative farmers, how do you maximize commodities so that people can earn a living either for themselves. And the other one that gets left out, and we heard it in the first session, with the role of the diaspora, which I think that despite the U.S. government and, you know, claims that they are doing a lot with SMEs and the diaspora, their level of what they consider an SME is really way above what most diasporans would consider an SME in terms of their capitalization level. So I think we need, and I sat on EXIM's committee as the chairman of the chairperson of the Africa Advisory, and one of the things I always say, the capitalization you put on SMEs, most diasporan companies cannot meet. It's just way too high. So we needed a special window, and we need special initiatives that look at helping in agriculture, that look to help in vocational training. Donors by far do not do enough in vocational training. We don't do enough in vocational training from the U.S. side, and most donors don't. And if you don't deal with entrepreneurship training, vocational training, SME, the agriculture sector, and the housing sector, then you're not going to be able to address the question that you raised. Those are the things that I would put on the table as automatically key to move forward. Because you're looking at a youth population of about 74 million. You have just about the same number of women. And mobilization of women is critical, and that's going to make me transition quickly, I know I'm out of time, to the democratization of the political process within parties. A lot of donors are doing a lot, and they did a lot in this election. Women were really mobilized in both parties, really. But what that means for transitioning to leadership positions for women has not really happened, and that needs to happen as well. The APC... Their convention in December was considered quite democratic in terms of how they move through the process. The key is, will they keep that kind of democratic processing and consensus building throughout the nomination process for ministers and post that in terms of how they work with the president? So all of those things to me are key, and all of those things are part of the development and the mobilization process that needs to go forward.
So we're quickly running out of time. Tom, I just want you to respond to the question about bunkering. It's been endemic. Can it change?
The bulk of bunkering still, is, according to my information, moves by sea. Mm. That requires, obviously, some kind of Coast Guard or Navy activity, not just to deal with smuggling, but to deal with exports, if I can put it this way, illegal exports. I think if it was clamped down, that might well help. But the really interesting question is enough being done in the Delta to be able, in fact, to provide an alternative? And Professor Subiru remarked, and I thought three very interesting items, that one has to be available to take care of. You cannot deprive a population even of illegal income at the moment without seeking to find a way to give them some kind of an alternative. Bunkering is not poppy production, but some of the same problems exist when you get involved in big money made fast through some kind of a process that you're going to stop. And the alternatives are very significant in terms of trying to move that way. People are very clever. They may find ways to move it without going to sea, as hard as that is. But I do think it's an exercise of government authority in the illegal export side of the market, and then maybe eventually in being able, Robin mentioned the police, and I couldn't agree more. They're even weaker than the Army is, but they, to some extent, need to deal with illegal activities in their jurisdiction as well. But it's a combination of clamping down and building up.
Capacity.
It can't be done totally on the negative side.
Kristen, let me just end with you on the tango question. Yeah, do programs like EITI really work, and can multinationals really be much more part of the solution to the corruption problem?
Well, I think the EITI program is important, but I'm glad you raised this question, because if there's a new report out from the Africa Union, which I'm sorry I don't have the exact title, on the nature of illegal capital flows out of Africa, and most of it goes through the private sector. So this is an area in which the international community can come together and work on our side, the private sector side, the international side of the corruption problem, along with the Nigerians and other governments. I think it's extremely important. Many of you know Raymond Baker has been working on this for years. He worked with the Africa Union on this. So this is another area where the international community can come in and support what President Buhari wants to do on the corruption side.
Thank you. We've run out of time, and let me thank all of you. Let me ask you to keep the spirit of Mwangi Kemeny alive. I commend his prolific body of work. It's all online, all at brookings.edu and elsewhere. And let me ask you to thank our tremendous panel.